call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum today. Before we get to the four bills on our agenda, do I have a motion to approve the meeting minutes from February 3rd, 2023?
So move, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Ingen moves the minutes for February 3rd, 2023. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The first bill we have on the agenda today is Representative Stevenson's bill. Members will be laying over House File 450. We had intended to move it out, but it's my understanding that it needs another amendment, which Representative Stevenson will explain so that we can have a discussion about the bill and the amendment that we anticipate coming, and then we'll lay it over and pull it back up again when that's ready. I will move that we lay over House File 450. Representative Stevenson, your bill is before us. Please go ahead and explain it to us.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 450 establishes a regime around the crime of organized retail theft. We actually had a preview of this bill on the House floor last night. Thanks to Representative Grossel for that, but Minnesota does not currently have a crime of organized retail theft. We charge, for new members, I work as a prosecutor for Hennepin County alongside the chair of this committee and when the legislature's not in session. And currently the way we handle retail theft, organized or not, is through a variety of statutes, including our theft statute, our shoplifting gear statute, our burglary tools statute. But what this bill is trying to do is create a differentiation between sort of low-level shoplifting offenses on the one hand and much more serious, much more organized, and frankly much more harmful organized retail theft, which is increasingly a problem in our community. And I think you'll hear from some testifiers about how that is impacting businesses in our community. But I will just say, from my own experience as a prosecutor, we do see a difference between sort of what you typically think of as a retail theft or a shoplift, a crime of convenience, of impulse, and increasingly some more organized and systemic retail theft that is much more problematic. So the bill gives law enforcement some tools in the form of access to certain financial records. It creates a new offense related to organized retail theft, defines it, creates enhanced penalties in certain circumstances. But on the flip side, it also tries to fix some of our laws that perhaps over-criminalize or over-penalize certain behavior that's probably more strictly thought of as shoplifting. So. And in some sense, what it also does is tries to standardize behavior that right now is handled very differently in different jurisdictions in the state. So there's a couple sections in the bill, Section 7, Section 8, that deal with an issue that I call trespass burglary. And to understand that, you have to understand that a burglary under Minnesota law is entering a building without consent and the intent to steal or commit a felony. That's all a burglary is. So let me give you a fact pattern. Let's suppose you go in to a Walgreens and steal anything, whatever you want. You know, a shirt, a candy bar, some Sudafed because you got a cold. Sudafed's a bad example since it's behind the counter. So let's go with Tylenol. Let's go with Tylenol, not Sudafed. Okay, you steal something and you get caught. Okay, as long as you haven't stolen more than $1,000, you're going to be guilty of a misdemeanor or a gross misdemeanor. And you're going to probably be trespassed by the store. The store is going to give you a notice saying, don't come back here, which is totally reasonable. You just stole. You shouldn't go back. Now, let's suppose you come back during the time that trespass notice is operational and steal again. And let's suppose you steal a candy bar, you know, a $2 item. Instead of being guilty of a misdemeanor theft, you are now guilty of a felony under Minnesota law, felony burglary in the third degree, because you have entered a building without consent, you had that trespass notice, and you stole. And this can lead to some really disproportionate situations. I once had a case where an individual who was in the circumstance took a bottle of mouthwash into the bathroom and drank the bottle of mouthwash in the bathroom. I mean, this person had a pretty serious substance abuse issue. And the charge that was submitted to the county attorney's office was for burglary. Okay? And it's not that there shouldn't be accountability for what happens there. It's just I don't think that's a burglary. I don't think it should be treated like a burglary. But even if you do, you should be troubled by the fact that depending upon which county you are in Minnesota right now, that case is going to be handled differently. Some counties won't charge. Their county prosecutors won't charge these trespass burglaries as felony burglaries. Some will, and some have charging guidelines where they'll charge them under some circumstances, and some not. So it's problematic from my perspective that the same conduct gets treated so differently in different parts of the state. So these sections try to flesh that out a little bit more, and it creates a new element to the fourth degree burglary statute that encompasses these trespass burglaries. So in most circumstances, that would now be a gross misdemeanor. But if you keep doing it, it eventually can be a felony. And that is the bill. Now, as the chair mentioned, we had some issues flagged for us after the amendment deadline that we want to address. So I appreciate the chair's willingness to hold over the bill while we continue to work on it. There's a technical change that probably needs to be made in the receiving portion of the bill to make clear that it's the person who's receiving the property has to have the intent to resell the merchandise. Right now it's unclear if it's that person or the person who originally stole the merchandise has to have that intent. We should make clear where the intent lies. There's a interaction with the shoplifting gear statute that needs to be resolved, and there's also a problem with regard to the length of time that the warrants are active down in the final section of the bill. So there's some stuff we're still working to iron out, largely technical in nature. And I appreciate the chair's willingness to give us some more time to do that. I know that there's a lot of testifiers, and I know I talked a lot. I'm sorry about that.
No, no worries. And members, I'll just note, too, that we have requested a fiscal note, but that we don't have one yet. So if you're looking for that in your packet, that is why. Our first testifier is Bruce Neustadt. So come on down. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. My name is Bruce Neustadt with the Minnesota Retailers Association. I work with small retailers, family-owned Main Street retailers, regional retailers, and large national retailers. I'm happy to be here today. I will say this is the first time this bill has been heard in the House, and we're really pleased to be able to talk about this issue, not because it's a great issue, but it's one that needs to be addressed, and we're deeply appreciative to Chair Stevenson for his work on this. I work also as a board member of an organization called the Minnesota Organized Retail Crime Association that you'll hear from in just a moment. And as Chair Stevenson said, this is a bill that's been worked on kind of in chunks, and I appreciate the good definition on the burglary changes. By the way, we think those make sense. I haven't talked to law enforcement or a store that doesn't say, you know what, that kind of makes sense based on the practice today. The other main part of the bill relates to sort of as the chair described as defining organized retail crime. And just from our perspective, it's definitely time to catch up Minnesota statutes with kind of the modern day career criminal. Today, there isn't the mob and the syndicate that we remember from the 70s, 80s, and maybe into the 90s. Today, organized retail crime looks a lot different. And it's based on technologies, and it's based on opportunity. And I think what Chair Stevenson's bill here does is a nice job sort of defining that, carving that out in statute. And we think of it really as a modernization of the statute as opposed to kind of a new offense. That's just my perspective. Organized retail crime is a $90 billion problem across the country. And believe it or not, you wouldn't think that maybe here in good old Minnesota we don't see as much of it. We actually do. And the problem continues to only get worse. It gets worse because you used to see the stories of national retailers and kind of big activities. You'd see those on the news. You're going to hear a story today of a little Canada entrepreneur who poured his life savings into his store, only to have all that life savings stolen and the store closed. So my point on that is this is not just a problem for large retailers or mid-sized retailers. It is a real problem for small retailers in each of our communities. I'm going to end there, Madam Chair, with just a quick note. Actually, a committee that you were in A couple days ago, I heard Chair Stevenson say this is not a silver bullet to a bill he was working on. And honestly, this is not the silver bullet for organized retail crime, but this is a great step in the right direction to modernize our laws. So with that, Madam Chair, I know there's some supplemental materials in your packet that I'd invite you to take a look at. And I'll end just by saying modernizing this area of law is not just good from a theft perspective, it's actually good for the safety of our consumers, for the safety of our retail workers, for the safety of our retailers, and really ultimately the safety of our communities as well. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Cody Johnson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cody Johnson, and I am the co-president of Minnesota Organized Retail Crime Association, or commonly known as MNORCA. I'm also a loss prevention professional of 17 years, but I am appearing today by my MNORCA co-president role. In 2014, a group of dedicated law enforcement, crime analysis, corporate fraud and loss prevention investigators and prosecutors created MNORCA as a 501c4 nonprofit public-private partnership to address ever-changing criminal enterprises. MNORCA uses tools such as a website complying with data privacy laws to share real-time crime information and intelligence on criminal groups to enhance the identification of offenders and the targeting of criminal enterprises. MNORCA strives to increase operational efficiency and effectiveness by minimizing redundancy and maximizing investigative potential through regional quarterly information meetings, ongoing training seminars, policy initiatives, and an annual conference. As you have heard, ORC is much more than shoplifting. ORC encompasses the multitude of theft and fraud schemes that occur in and through retail environments, thus negatively impacting commerce and undermining consumer safety, employee safety, as well as overall public safety. Offenders involved in ORC commit crimes to include theft, identity theft, fraud, and other property crimes in order to illegally obtain merchandise. These stolen or fraudulently obtained items are monetized, oftentimes provided the resources to support other unlawful acts. ORC and related crimes cost legitimate businesses, American taxpayers, and our government over $30 billion per year. I want to make sure you have time to hear from Mr. Dillon today, so I'll cut my comments off there and end by saying I strongly support differentiating petty theft from organized retail crime in Minnesota laws. Thank you for considering the bill before you today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Walter Dillon is the next testifier. Welcome to the committee. You can introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. Good morning, everybody. My name is Walter Dillon. And
if you don't mind pulling that mic, you can a little bit closer.
Maybe is that better?
That's much better. Thank
okay.
you. Okay. Start over.
Sorry, guys. My name is Walter Dillon. And I had a small sneaker shop in Little Canada. Kind of was like a dream of mine for a while. And kind of like talked my wife into going into business with me and going for a sneaker shop. You know, nobody in my family never did it. I just went out on a whim and went for it. But within, I would say, about 4 or 5 months, I was broken into about five times. And it kind of just like crushed me. You know, it was three things I always wanted to be in life. I was a good family man, a good businessman, and a pillar of my community. With those incidents, it kind of broke some of those things. My loving wife, she supported me through it. I didn't really seem to get too much help from law enforcement or whatever. And I don't think it was a personal thing. I think they just had so much on their plate that they couldn't get to me, just being a small business. And just being broken into, a lot of people was disappointed. A lot of people was disappointed. And with the last break-in, what made this one so unique was my wife was in labor February 23rd. This time last year, my wife was in labor. And as she was giving birth, my ADT system called me. And I knew what it was. And I had to leave the birth of my son to run down to my store to address the issue of somebody breaking into the store. Broke my heart. I couldn't even cut my son's umbilical cord. I missed it. Completely missed the birth of my son because somebody was breaking into my store. Devastated me. So just want to let you guys know that being a small business, and I believe these organized guys breaking into these stores, crushing their dreams, because they put me out of business, but they still going on. They still thriving. It put me in a depression for a while. Now, remember, my wife just gave birth. I got a brand new son at home. And I was going through something also. And I do believe these is organized crimes. I don't believe the punishment is harsh enough. And they're doing more damage than anything, especially to small businesses, who's actually trying to be pillars of the community and do something positive. I had about 4 young guys working with me. And I knew the time when they was working with me, they wasn't nowhere close to trouble. They was nowhere close to trouble. That's the part of me giving back to the community, being a pillar of my community. It was a family business. Me and my wife, we love coming into the sneaker shop and greeting the customers Saturday, Sunday, and just seeing the smiles on those guys' faces when they come and buy a shoe or just come in to talk. Just talk about the latest thing going on. And I was supporting my family in the most rightest way you could ever support your family. I was supporting my family. My kids was good. My wife was good. My community was good. I was good. And I just feel like the break-ins constantly, no matter how much I upgraded my alarm system, it's just more break-ins. It crushed all those dreams I had, crushed them all. And this was in Little Canada. I thought this was the second safest place in Minnesota besides my home. With me having so many break-ins in my plaza, my lease was forced to be non-void. So not only did I get robbed, but I got kicked out also. I got broken into so much that my insurance didn't even honor any more claims. There was no more claims for the year. I was already 4 or 5 months into my store and my new location with the 5 break-ins that the insurance didn't even honor it. So I never got any compensation for anything that got stolen or damaged. Me and my wife, we had to eat those charges. The plaza we was renting out, we had to vacate that. And I had to just go on with my life best way I could while those guys is out there still thriving and still doing the same thing. They don't stop. They don't quit. Why would they? There's nothing to stop them. Like I say, I upgraded my alarm systems every time afterwards. And it still got me no closer to catching whoever was doing it.
Thank you, Mr. Dillon. Well, I want to make sure that we have enough time to discuss this bill, too.
Yes.
I didn't know if you had another sentence you wanted to say. Okay, great.
I said my piece.
Thank you so much for your testimony, and I'm sorry for those horrible experiences.
Well, let's make sure this get passed.
Thank you. I don't have anybody else on the list, but I don't know if there are any other members of the public who wish to testify. And I'm not seeing anybody, so we will go ahead and move to member discussion. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I thank you so much, Representative Stevenson, for bringing this forward. I've got a couple of, I know this bill's being laid over, and so I guess I want to talk with you separately about a couple pieces, but just as I was looking at this, maybe I'll bring up a couple points now. One is, as I'm thinking about the changes to the burglary offenses, I'm just one thing to consider, I guess, as it moves forward is individual buildings versus chains. So I'm thinking about, you know, somebody who's trespassed from, somebody who's stolen a bunch from Target stores. And I feel like often in my county anyway, somebody will get a stay-away order from all Target stores. The way this is phrased is, you know, if you enter the building within 1 year after being told to leave the building and not return, and that might be something just to just to think about how that works. Mm-hmm. And maybe we want to just restrict it to the individual store, given the nature of this. We don't want to have a chain, but just something for you to for you to consider. And maybe I'll note in my county it is the case that it does. I think our practice is that it generally does take a couple times of somebody entering and having a trespass, stay-away order, and somebody, a trespass order, somebody comes in precisely because it is a felony, right, that we don't want to necessarily bring a felony charge for somebody who's shoplifting a small amount after being told. The way this is set up is, you know, just the one time after 1 year, which makes sense to me. I do think we want to think about how this is structured so it wouldn't be interpreted that circumstances that don't apply. I'm looking at your paragraph B on page 8, I guess the two paragraph Bs, that somebody would not be, if they fall outside of B, they then go back to A and still can get charged with a felony, even if, you know, it's more than a year, even if they don't have one of those prior convictions. I really like the way you've structured this, but these are just a couple of drafting points to consider, probably along with our amazing counsel. So just a few thoughts for you. I've got a couple thoughts on the organized retail theft piece of it as well. Maybe we can talk about that separately. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Further discussion? Representative Navani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And I think this is going to start a dangerous precedent because I know from the other bills coming up, I'm going to be agreeing with Representative Pinto several times in the next week here. But we have concerns also about the wording of it. And we have the specific language that says after being told to leave as opposed to using the trespass terms. You know, being trespassed from a building is a specific process and a notification. We question, as Representative Pinto pointed out, is it all the chains? Is it one store? You know, I look at Walmart, it's got 80 stores in the state alone. Could you hit all 80 stores and just keep going to a different one and the end of the year just start over again? We're confused by that. And then do you want it to be a specific trespassing notification, or what constitutes notification and formal notice? That's our concerns. If you want to work on that with your amendment and clean that up, just to make it better and more enforceable. I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Chair.
Yep, Representative Stevenson.
Yeah, I appreciate the feedback from both Representative Navani and Representative Pinto, and I think in particular the chain issue is something really worth thinking about. The truth is, funny story, this section, and I don't know if Mr. Johnson recalls this, but this was actually the first, this part of this bill was the first thing I worked on as not even sworn in, but elected legislator. I emailed Mr. Johnson from my Gmail account and asked for help drafting this. And my memory is that there was a reason why we went with the asked not to return that had to do with trespass notices. And I see Mr. Johnson's reaching for his microphone. I wasn't going to put him on the spot, but if he has more memory about why we settled on this language, I certainly am always impressed by his memory and defer to him on that. But that's why we did that. I do also just want to say briefly before Mr. Johnson speaks, to your point about going around the state to all these places, keep in mind that, like, we're still talking about conduct that isn't rising up to a felony for any number of different reasons. So, for example, the person who was who testified, the business owner here, who was talking about breaking in to his store, right? That doesn't fall under this section of the bill because the store has to be open to the public, right? And he was talking about being broken into. You break in, you're still in third-degree burglary, felony land. Likewise, if you're stealing more than $1,000, that's a felony theft. And remember that we have an aggregate rule in Minnesota. So if you were to go from store to store to store, even if they're in different counties, we can aggregate that together to get over 1,000 and get to the felony threshold. So it's an excellent point that we should think about the chain issue. I think I recognize that. I just also want to point out that these things all kind of work in concert. But on the enter and not return language. I don't know if Mr. Johnson recalls how we talked about it.
Looks like he is ready to answer that question. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, Ben Johnson with House Research. The language is identical to the current trespass statute, which is section 609.605. It's subdivision 1, paragraph B, clause 8. That clause says that it's a trespass to return to the property of another within 1 year after being told to leave the property and not to return. So that's why the language is in the statute as it is.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any follow-up, Representative Navani?
No, Chair. Thank you.
Great. And it does sound like these discussions will be helpful to have before we bring this bill back up again. Representative Whitty.
Thank you. This is an issue I've heard from retailers in my district and one that I experienced firsthand working in law enforcement. I like that we're having this discussion about trespassing because the times when I went even to a chain, they would get a trespass notice and told not to go back to that same store but any others because the problem is that's where they go return it to. They may steal it from Burnsville, but then they go to Egan, and that's where they collect the money. So I think we really should have those discussions. So I'm glad all of us are open to that, but that's just given a little experience. But what surprised me was to hear from a local grocery store about how it impacts their bottom line. What is most stolen item in one grocery store in Lakeville would surprise you. It's Tide detergent. They go to Facebook Marketplace and search for Tide, and you'll see a lot of options for sale. And I don't think those are the people that are buying them in the pallet and the small margins that hurts the store. So I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I'm glad we're going to have more discussions on the trespassing thing because I think it can make a big difference for our retailers and, give them some tools. Thank you.
Further member discussion, closing comments, Representative Stevenson.
Well, I appreciate the great instruction, great conversation and the tips, and happy to work on those and look forward. If you have other suggestions, I know Representative Pinto said he's something he's going to talk offline, that extend to everyone else on the committee. If they have ideas, happy to talk those through. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'll renew my motion and lay over House File 450. The next bill on the agenda is House File 818. It's a Representative Feist bill, so we'll give Vice Chair Feist a minute to get to the testifiers' table. We'll also be laying over House File 818, so I'll move that we bring the bill forward, and I'll move to lay over House File 818. Representative Feist, when you are ready, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee. The Violence Prevention Project Research Center is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research center dedicated to reducing violence in society using data and analysis to improve police and practice. The center's research on mass shootings has received global media attention. Areas of expertise include mass shootings, school shootings, gun violence, violent extremism, cyber violence, trauma, mental illness, street gangs, and youth violence. The Violence Project works with stakeholders across a wide range of sectors, K-12 education, higher education, law enforcement, retail, medicine, and public health. With funding, the Violence Project can develop into a nonpartisan regional gun violence research and policy center that would provide a centralized hub for research, data analysis, and evidence-based policy development on gun violence prevention and intervention. I'll let my experts provide a lot more detail than that about their important work, but I just wanted to point out that what we're talking about here is different than the really important and robust research that goes on internally within the Department of Public Safety. The Violence Project is able to do history, life history interviews, focus groups, victim conversations, trying to get at root causes of gun violence, and they're also more public-facing for the general public to have access to this data, and are able to evaluate existing policy within DPS. So they are a distinct type of research and analysis center that we're talking about today. And with that, I will turn it over to my experts, the co-founders of the Violence Project.
Thank you. We have Dr. Jillian Peterson and Dr. James Stensley. If you both want to come down, I don't know how you're going to do your presentation or testimony. So if you want to just both come down and crowd around the testifier table
here.
And just before you talk, if you can each introduce yourselves for the record.
Yes. My name is Jillian Peterson. I'm one of the co-founders of the Violence Project, along with James Densley. James is a sociologist by training and a former special education teacher. I am a psychologist by training and a former investigator on death penalty cases. I developed life histories of people facing the death penalty, and through that work became very passionate about preventing gun violence before it occurs from its root causes, rather than reacting to it and minimizing casualties. So the Violence Project started about 3 years ago as a small volunteer-based nonprofit. We've seen just an exponential growth of our work that now has global reach, and it's really incredible to see kind of the desire for our approach. We conduct nonpartisan research really focused on root causes of violence, embracing the complexity of gun violence research and how sort of complicated the solutions can be. So we use both statistical analysis and things like focus groups, interviews with perpetrators themselves who are incarcerated. We interview victims, community stakeholders, and the people directly impacted. One example is our mass shooter research, where through building a database and conducting dozens of interviews, we identified this pathway to violence that mass shooters go through. And you can intervene at any point along that pathway. So from, you know, universal trauma screening or social emotional learning to crisis response teams, suicide prevention training, anonymous reporting systems, to social media literacy and holding social media companies accountable, all the way up until somebody in crisis at risk of hurting themselves or other can obtain a firearm. And so you can intervene sort of at any point along that pathway, and we don't see any of those is competing with each other, but really complementing each other. And I think because of that complex approach, we've seen people drawn to our work across the political spectrum because we embrace how complicated and complex this is. Our goal is really public-facing research. So research that anyone, the general public, policymakers, media, can interact with, and that data can help push our policy conversations forward and really bring us together around prevention. And we're in the process of really expanding our work to all forms of gun violence, so doing deep dives into community homicides, domestic homicides, and suicides. And with that, I'll pass it over to Dr. Densley.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to present here today. And I will just expand upon how that was left, which is that we are developing into other forms of gun violence. And so what is exciting about the prospects of this funding is that it enables us to really accelerate and build on that foundation of building trustworthy, public-facing, with global impact research into new spaces. So we want to continue to maintain and develop the mass shooter database that we have. We want to continue to do the K-12 school shooting database that we are in partnership with. But we also want to do a nationally representative survey and a statewide survey across Minnesota around experiences of gun violence, for the first time to capture the lived experience of gun violence on a way that is truly representative. In so doing, we can also capture public opinion around policy to prevent gun violence. We want to also do work looking at safe storage laws, red flag laws, and other policies that are being proposed to truly understand and evaluate those policies to see how are they having an impact and where they can be possibly improved. So this creates an opportunity for us to continue to expand upon the foundation that we have built, to do new and innovative nonpartisan research that is public-facing and that can inform practitioners and policymakers to ensure that they're making evidence-based and data-driven decisions going forward. And I think with that, we've probably run out of time. So very happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't see that we have any other members of the public signed up to testify. Is there anybody else? Mr. Dorr, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Doerr. I'm the vice president of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus, and I am actually a huge fan of the Violence Project. I've spoken to both of the doctors. I've attended all of their seminars that they've had in Minnesota, their webinars. I've got their book. It's dog-eared on my shelf with a bunch of great data points. I think they do really fantastic work. I think when I look at the language of this bill, there's a couple things that just come to mind that I'd like to highlight with hopes that maybe we could get a little bit more clarity. One is just the term gun violence. You guys have heard my good friend Sue Aberholden from NAMI talk about how that term encompasses maybe people. It creates this idea that suicide is a violent action rather than somebody who might need some help. When you lump it together with violent crime, it takes this idea that the solutions to violent crime and the solutions to suicide are similar, and I think they're very different. They require different strategies and different approaches. And then if everything that they just said they wanted to do was in the language of the bill, I think that that'd be really great. I think all of that would give us a lot of good information, a lot of good data to work from. I just think that the language of the bill doesn't provide those types of guardrails. So it might be good to be a little bit more specific about what the funding can be used for and what it can't be used for. I'm sure you guys wouldn't want our organization doing a research, and I certainly wouldn't, because there's a certain bias that'll be inherently associated with it, and same for the other side of the issue, just to make sure that it is truly nonpartisan academic data that's being researched and provided. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Any other members from the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. I'm not seeing any, so we will open it up to member discussion. And I think we have an amendment, so maybe let's get to that first before we have further discussion. There is an A1 amendment in the packet, and I believe Representative Novotny, are you offering the A1?
I am, Chair.
All right. Please explain your amendment to us.
The amendment is basically just enacting what everyone's saying, that it's nonpartisan and we'd like to keep them that way. So the amendment, which speaking with Representative Feist, she indicates she'll take it as a friendly amendment, prohibits contributing any money or making in-kind contributions to any candidate. And it goes on, basically no PAC activity and things like that. So just seems just keeping it clean, and that's the guts of the amendment.
Thank you. Representative Feist, the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Novotny. I think that this is a good idea. It's important that the center is perceived as and is in effect or in actuality nonpartisan. So I would encourage members to vote yes on this amendment.
Okay, and I think Representative Hollins, too, and then Representative Frazier on the amendment.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist. I'm a little confused about why this amendment is needed. As a 501c3, they're not allowed to provide support to candidates or organizations. So that's my first question. My second question is, does this prohibit future enactment of something like the NRA Victory Fund, which does donate to political candidates, and is, was it a 501c4, is that correct? Yeah, 501c4. So, two-part question, why is this necessary, and does this prohibit future enactment of a political arm?
Representative Banks.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. As from my perspective, I think it's an optics thing, and I think that the data that the center will collect will be better received by all members of the community and policymakers, so that we can really rely on data-driven responses to gun violence. As far as how this amendment on this particular center would impact other restrictions on nonprofits, I don't think that it would have any impact. But I agree with you that it may not be strictly necessary, but I feel comfortable with it.
Representative Hollins.
So by my reading of it, it says the Violence Prevention Project Research Center may not establish or associate with a political action committee for the purposes of making a contribution. And that... I understand why that might be the case. It worries me a little bit to see future restrictions regarding political action committees being put into our statute. especially when we know the NRA donates a lot of money to a lot of political candidates and political causes. So I respect you, Representative Feist, and I will vote the way you want me to, but I do want to express my concern and have that on the record.
Representative Frazier.
I had the same concerns. Representative Holland addressed the issue about the 501c3, but I have the same concerns, Representative Feist.
Did you want to respond?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this input. And I don't think we're very far apart from each other in how we perceive this. I think since, I don't know that anybody, well, I shouldn't say that. I think that this data and this research will be more effectively utilized by policymakers with this language, and that's why I support it, but I hear you.
And I'll just note again, too, that we're laying over the bill. So if we adopt the amendment now and there needs to be some further tweaking of this language, that's certainly something that we can do before we bring the bill back up again. There's something that would make folks more comfortable with it. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Chair. And sort of related, just would caution, I understand comfort language and that it might make some folks more likely to support the bill, but if the end result is the same, putting then in the interpretation of things down the line is sort of, well, how come this isn't in some other bill? And it just, we can run into problems. So I just want to caution us against putting unnecessary comfort language into any of our bills, just because it does, we can run into problems down the line that may have ramifications outside of this bill. But overall, I think this is a good bill. Just not really comfortable with the amendment as is, because I don't think it's necessary for the same reasons already stated.
Further discussion on the amendment. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if anyone in the room has the answer to this, but is the NRA receiving state funds?
I am not sure we have the answer to that question.
Okay. I would guess that the answer is no. And so the intent here, and Representative Amati can correct me if I'm wrong, the intent here is to ensure that we're not funneling taxpayer money to an organization under the auspices that it's going to perform a particular task that's in the state's interest, and then those funds turn around and end up being used for political purposes that are partisan in nature. And if indeed there's a fear, which I'm hearing, that that might become a standard, that's a little alarming. I mean, I would think that that's something that we ought to be able to all agree should not happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to beat a dead horse, but this language specifically says that they are not allowed to establish or associate with a political action committee. So this money is not money that would go to a political action committee necessarily, but we're saying they're not allowed to associate or create one in the future with future money that they might get from private donors as the NRA does. So that's my concern. When we put a prohibition in here that has no timeline on it and we're saying for indefinite amount of time, we are not going to allow them to do that. That's something that worries me. Thank you.
Representative Frazier.
I can't state it any more eloquently or precise than Representative Hollins just did.
Representative Curran.
Yeah, just to throw in, prior to being in the legislature, I spent 20 years at a 501c3. I'm very familiar with what the current laws and regulations are. And I have to say that being this specific with one organization receiving money where this is already prohibited by the IRS and widely followed and legally has to be followed, I'd have to be a no vote on this amendment.
Final discussion on your amendment, Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. Confused, perplexed. I was going to ask Representative Hollins if she plans on offering a verbal amendment to give money to the NRA, but we're talking about something that's not in the bill. We specifically state that we're a nonpartisan group, that we're giving this money to a nonpartisan group, $2 million over the biennium, and we can't even put language in that says that we'll follow the law. I ask for a roll call vote.
Okay, a roll call. And, oh, I'm sorry, Representative, and I thought you were to the bill. I didn't realize, I know you put your name on the list, but I thought that was to the bill, not to, did you have something to say about the amendment?
That's correct.
I'm so sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just think that if we truly want this data, and actually Chair Mueller and I, we discussed the book that Mr. Doerr had spoke of, and it seems like what you guys are doing right now is extremely impactful. And it's great for policymakers because it's perceived as just nothing but the truth. The data's there, the statistics are there, and they're not skewed. So that's why I think that this amendment should be adopted, is because it could give the perception that the group's work, which has been great, could be perceived as something that's simply a partisan tool. And therefore, many folks who are in the pro-2A community specifically just wouldn't be able to look at it within the same light. So that's my take on this, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Botany, did you have one more thing to say?
Just a quick clarification, Chair. Thank you. And for the testifiers, what exactly is your organization? Is it 501c3? Or is
correct, 501c3.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. Wrapping this up, just saying, I guess I have great concerns that it's 501c3. If the amendment is simply copying what that law is, then it's unnecessary. If it's going beyond that, I guess I have concerns about the kind of activities in the future. So yeah, I'll just say I if it's simply 501c3, that's all that's going on, then it's already the law. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I'll just point out again that it's my intent, because of the author's agreeance with this, that I'm going to vote yes on this, and that we can further discuss this before we bring the bill back up again. Oh, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mueller?
Aye.
Mueller, yes. Vice Chair Feist?
Aye.
Feist, yes. Representative Novotny?
Yes.
Novotny, yes. Representative Becker Finn?
Nope.
Becker Finn, no. Representative Curran?
No.
Curran, no. Representative Ingen?
Yes.
Ingen, yes. Representative Fraser?
No.
Fraser, no. Representative Grussell?
Yes.
Grussell, yes. Representative Hollins?
No.
Hollins, no. Representative Hudson?
Yes.
Hudson, yes. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Mueller, yes. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, yes. Representative Tapke?
No.
Tapke, no. Representative Witte?
Yes.
Witte, yes. With 9 ayes and 5 nays, that concludes the roll call vote.
There being 9 ayes and 5 ayes, the A1 amendment is adopted. All right, now we can move on to a discussion of the bill as amended. Member discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And overall, I think this is a good bill. And I think the concern about the use of the word violence, we could go round and round on the definition of violence and whether it applies in a suicide situation versus other types of gun violence. But I think we just, as a suggestion, as we move this through, we could just add "and gun deaths" at the end of that sentence, I think that would encompass that and make it more clear that we're talking about both those scenarios, and not necessarily saying that, sort of lifting up the concerns of the folks from NAMI and others in that community. But I think that would be an easy fix as we move this forward. So thank you.
Comment to that, Representative Feist.
Yep, thank you. Thanks for this input. I agree. I will point members to the letter from NAMI that has supported the Violence Project's work. And I'll quote them as saying that they found that they've specifically moved the narrative away from blaming people with mental illness and focusing on the root causes and warning signs. So I think that language makes sense, and I think it is aligned with the work of the Violence Project.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. Feist, for this bill, and that we are going to be having some holistic look at this. I'm looking at the bill language, and in light of the OLA report that we just got that talked about grant mismanagement, There is no reporting language or any type of language that would require the group to report back to the legislature. I know that you talked about that this is available for the community, but if the goal is for us to be, you know, being informed legislators on how to make good informed decisions on what legislation to pass, we really need to have some sort of legislation that says that you're required to give reporting language. Also, we need to make sure that the finances are being used for what they're supposed to be used for. And again, with the most recent OLA report showing that there has been some mismanagement of funds, especially in this area, we really want to make sure that we don't besmirch any of the work that you guys are already doing.
And before you answer, Representative Feist, I'm not sure the answer to this question. I don't know, because this is going through the Commissioner of Public Safety, if any of their other reporting requirements would be required to be kicked in. And perhaps you know the answer to that, but go ahead and address this question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do not know the answer to that, although I do know that is the case that often, like another bill that I'm handling later this week, the Office of Justice Programs already collects a lot of the data that we would need as policymakers and as the public to ensure that the funds are being wisely and ethically spent. I will note that as a nonprofit, the Violence Project has annual 990 forms that are very detailed public tax filings that talk about the way that funds have been spent. And then I would also note just that the whole point of the Violence Project is that it is incredibly public-facing, that the data and the work is available to the public and to policymakers. I'm happy to talk offline about this, but in general, I feel fairly confident that we will have the information we need to know that this money is being invested in the way that we intend.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you so much. Just maybe even anything, because we've seen in the past just a report, they have to report back to the legislature or something, just language like that. I hear what you're saying with their 990 forms and making sure that there's other reporting standards from DPS. I get that. But almost every grant application that I've seen or any other initiative that I've seen, there's almost always January 15th or whatever, there is a report that's given to the legislature. So that would be my recommendation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion to the bill? Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I sometimes think that when we ask for these reports back, it's a negative. And I actually see it as a positive, because it can show that the money that we appropriated and the results, it gives you confidence when the bills come forward again. And then when you hear a report like that, it just makes it easier to validate it. So for me personally, I'd love to see a report come back even to this committee a year from now, understanding the results and what we've gotten done. And so I don't want it always to be a negative. I think there's positives in it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Whitty. Any further discussion? Closing comments, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. I think that the work of the Violence Project is incredibly important, impressive, and increasingly important to public safety. And I would urge members, we're just laying it over, but when it comes time to vote, I would urge members to support this funding. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist, and to the testifiers today. I'll renew my motion and lay over House File 818 as amended. Thank you. Members, the next bill on our agenda is a Representative Wolgamott bill. I see him over there. We'll also be laying over House File 610, so I will move that we lay over House File 610. Representative Wolgamott, your bill is before us. I don't see any amendments filed. So I should say your first bill is before us, because you have two before us today. Please go ahead and explain House File 610.
Chair Mueller, Lead Novotny, and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me before you today to present House File 610, which would provide $1 million for a grant to Heroes Helping Heroes, a Minnesota 501c3 nonprofit organization. Madam Chair and members, this grant will fund mental health support for present and former law enforcement officers and first responders who have experienced traumatic events and are facing employment-related mental health issues as a result of those traumatic events, using interactive group activities and other proven methods. A little bit of context for you why we were asking for this appropriation, Madam Chair and members, is, as we all know, mental health issues are impacting our society more than ever. This includes our law enforcement officers and other first responders who are regularly exposed to traumatic events as part of their duties on a daily basis. Yet stigma still remains that sharing one's struggles with mental health is seen as a sign of weakness. While cultures and departments across the state are changing, law enforcement officers and other first responders need our support. Not only will this investment put forward in House File 610 allow us to have a positive impact in the lives of our law enforcement officers and other first responders, but it will also have a great impact on the lives of their families and the communities in which they're a part of and whom they serve. At a time where staffing shortage is at a near or all-time low for most departments, this is more important than ever to help our brave men and women get the help they so desperately need and deserve. And Madam Chair, before I turn it over to my two testifiers, I would just like to recognize my gratitude for support from my colleagues who have signed on to this bill. Committee member Representative Curran, Representative Hewitt, and Representative Tapke, as well as Representative Lilly, Representative Katisa-Watoon, and Representative Norris. I appreciate their support, and I hope that everyone here in this room and in our chamber can join us in supporting this bill and the incredible work that's being done by this organization. So with that, Madam Chair, I do have some testifiers to provide further insight into Heroes Helping Heroes, the great work that they do, and why this appropriation is so needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Volgamott. It looks like we have Chris Stewart as our first testifier today, so please introduce yourself, welcome to the committee, and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today. Again, I would like to send a special thanks to Representative Volgamott and our co-authors for introducing this bill here today. My name is Chris Stewart. I am a retired Minneapolis Police Sergeant and now founder and president of Heroes Helping Heroes. After spending 14 plus years with Minneapolis Police Department, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, in June of 2020. During my career with Minneapolis, I've seen well over 200 dead bodies, hundreds more shooting victims, and even more who have been brutally assaulted and violently attacked. As first responders, we deal with gosh-awful, horrific things on a daily basis and deal with pure evil much more often than we should. You can't go through this career as a first responder seeing these horrific things without having them change who you are as an individual. Sometimes it becomes too much. That is why I created Heroes Helping Heroes. We're a nonprofit 501c3 organization dedicated to helping all first responders, police, fire, and EMS who are suffering from work-related mental health issues, specifically PTSD. We're for both active and retired first responders, and we provide events such as hunting, fishing, camping, woodworking, candle making, etc., all at no cost to our members. It's a different way for them to deal with the stresses of their professions. With nearly 58% of our members still being active, it is vitally important that we continue to provide them the help and resources necessary so they can continue to do a profession that they love. For retired first responders, is providing them the help and resources that their departments fail to do. With over 600 members throughout the entire state and growing weekly, we have hosted over 90 events and helped over 1,000 first responders and their members, with 100% of our proceeds going directly back into the foundation. As our membership continues to grow and the changes the needs of our members continue to change, so do we. One of the things that I'm happy to announce that we're going to be doing this year is that as more of our first responders who have left the profession in 2020 and 2021 are now in a mentally safe spot to go back into the workforce and contribute to society again, we're teaming up with organizations and companies to provide work resume building classes. We're also partnering up with a local community college and businesses to provide the resources and the means necessary for our members to get into the trades professions, such as auto mechanics, diesel mechanics, plumbing, electrician, and welding, etc. We're also announcing this year that we are providing scholarships for individuals who want to follow their childhood dreams and become a firefighter, police officer, or paramedic. With your help and support, we can continue to grow as an organization and provide help for all of our first responders, especially those who are still currently working, so we can provide them the help and resources necessary so that they can continue to do a profession that they love and serve and protect the communities in which they live and work. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Our next testifier is Jeff Imming. Welcome to the council. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Imming, I-M-M-I-N-G. I'm currently a sergeant with the Minneapolis Police Department. So a little background with my occupation. So I'm currently a 25-year member of the Minneapolis Police Department. I was promoted to sergeant in 2018. Chris and I were actually promoted around the same time, so we worked together in 2018. So I can tell you, in my experience, I've dealt with critical incidents, is what Chris is referring to, of having PTSD. And this is not a topic that was well talked about, or it was kind of taboo in the profession to talk about it. But recently it's been brought up to, you know, several officers and precincts where it's talked a little bit more openly now. And like, to expand on what Chris said, I've seen several homicides, shootings, stabbings, domestic assaults, drive-by shootings, and the list goes on and on. So it is and has been a struggle recently to, get up and do the job that I'm currently doing. But I believe in this organization, and it has helped me. And I've been a spokesperson, you know, for this organization through my current occupation. I encourage all my officers to attend these events. And I could say that it's actually the only group that I know of that it's proactive instead of reactive. So you can be a proactive organization by calling your members and checking them, whether, you know, to see how you're doing, how you're coping with things, versus a reactive would be counseling and seeing a counselor, psychologist. The individual would have to want that type of help, versus the Heroes group is a proactive group that reaches out to all their members. So with that, I'll end on that note. So
thank you. Thanks for your testimony. I don't see that we have anybody else on the testifier list, but are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? I'm not seeing any. We'll move to member discussion. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I've participated in a couple of these events, and I see the impact it has on them. As a retired police officer, 27 years, most public safety sees about 850 critical incidents in their lifetime. And how do you deal with that? I like that there's the component of present and retired, because even after they leave the law enforcement profession, we do need to help them. Chris has done an outstanding job and shining a light on this, and I give him a lot of credit as he fights through everything in his own personal life, but just sharing his story. So I'm in support of this. I've participated. I would encourage all of you to come to an event and support them. It's much needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you. I mean, I was just looking at the website. It looks like there's a lot of good programming that happens. I'm wondering, though, if you could speak to kind of the demographics or who's served currently by the program. You know, is it a statewide program? Is it primarily folks in a certain part of the metro? Or just want to know who these services are available to.
Mr. Stewart.
Madam Chair, thank you. Like I was stating earlier, we have over 600 members throughout the entire state, ranging from Moorhead, east to Duluth, down to the Twin Cities, down to southeast Minnesota and Pipestone, from Lake of the Woods all the way down to Houston County. So we got members throughout the entire state. We provide events throughout the entire state. Our goal with additional funding is to provide more resources to members throughout the entire state to open up chapters so more events are accessible to more members. As far as demographics, roughly 58% of our members are still active. 75% are currently law enforcement. We have 15% firefighters, 5% EMS, and 5% corrections.
Representative Beckerfin. All right, great. You had all of the statistics right on hand. Thank you so much. That was super helpful. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And I just wanted to take a moment. I don't want to repeat too much of what Representative Woody says. I know we share a lot on this issue. And I just wanted to thank Representative Wolgamott for bringing this forward. Thank you, Mr. Stewart, for sharing your story. And, of course, Mr. Imming, for your support as well. I encountered events that unfortunately led me to have PTSD 5 years ago as a law enforcement officer. I wish this was around or that I knew about it at the time. So I just wanted to say thank you, and I really appreciate this work.
Representative Wolgamott, did you have something to say? I couldn't tell if you
were. Oh, no.
Okay. Representative Navani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. To the author, Representative Wolgamott, notice it's a one-time appropriation. Is there any with the reasoning behind that or any thought to going continuing?
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Lee Navani. Yes, we would like to, this is one time, we would like to see this appropriation go through and be able to show you and members of the committee, members of the legislature, what Heroes Helping Heroes can do with this money, and then come back in the future for additional funds to be able to empower the good work that they do for our law enforcement suffering PTSD-related issues.
Representative Navani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And to the testifiers, Sergeant Stewart, Sergeant Emming, thank you for being here. Thank you for bringing this cause. Going to get through this without breaking up, so I'll wrap it up at that. Thank you, Chair Mueller.
Yeah, thank you. And I just have a question because this came up in the last bill, and it wasn't something that I had thought about for this one, about reporting requirements. I don't see that there is any specific report to the legislature on this bill. And again, I don't know if this is something that DPS would have reporting requirements on. But maybe, Mr. Stewart, if you can just talk about anything that you have with respect to reporting back on the work that your organization does.
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, we keep detailed data about every member who participates in our events. So we already have that data available to us. We continue to do so. So that way, if members of the public are interested to see, hey, what impact are we actually making, we've got statistics and data on hand. And same thing with reporting back to you guys as a board is we're more than willing to and actually happy to. I'm excited to share the progress and the number of people we continue to help to you guys just to show that, hey, we are making a difference out there.
Yeah, thank you. And to echo what Representative Whitty said on the last bill, too, sometimes those reporting requirements are very helpful in seeing the good work that's being done. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Stewart, thank you for being here to present, and thank you for doing this work. And I just wanted to thank all of the first responders that are here in the audience. We see you. Thank you for being here, and thank you for all the work that you do. I have first responders in my family. Thank you again, Mr. Stewart, for the work that you're doing. This is very important. I know that we've got a lot of first responders that are dealing with PTSD issues now, and I know there's another bill percolating to work with that to make sure they get the resources they need to get them back to where they should be and having some dignity and life and moving forward to address their PTSD issues. So thank you for being one of the tools that can help them do that. And I also will be remiss to say, but I am happy that I didn't see an amendment to address guardrails, because this is a 501c3 and they're already covered by federal law to deal with those issues. So thank you again. Thank you, Representative Wolgamott, for bringing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Representative Wolgamott, closing comments.
Well, thank you again, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to present to you House File 610. In closing, I would like to share four statistics that really underscore the need for Heroes Helping Heroes and how important it is that we provide this grant funding. The average police officer will be involved in or witness over 850 critical incidents in their career, compared to an average of less than 5 for the general public. The U.S. Department of Justice estimates that 15% of law enforcement officers suffer from PTSD. In Minnesota, the number of duty disability applications filed by public safety professionals doubled between 2019 and 2021, and 80% of those applications are PTSD related. And across the United States, roughly 200 first responders died by suicide each year from 2017 to 2022, and there have already been 15 such deaths in 2023. Madam Chair and members, we are so lucky to have Heroes Helping Heroes doing the work that they are doing in our state, and I cannot think of a better investment that this committee can make, that our state can make, in the work that they are doing. I urge your support for House File 610 as you consider your public safety finance omnibus bill. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Stewart, for creating this group, and thank you for your consideration, members.
Thank you, Representative Folgemot, and thanks again to our testifiers today. We really appreciate you being here and the work you're doing. So I will renew my motion and lay over House File 610. We will move now to another Representative Folgemot bill, House File 1200. And I'll just note that it is Corrections Officers Day on the Hill. And so that is who mostly we are seeing. They came into the committee here during hearing. So welcome to all our corrections officers who are here today. We're happy to see you here. House File 1200, I believe the motion is that I will be moving House File 1200 to be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Folgemot, if you want to go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Lead Novotny and committee members, for the opportunity to come before you today to present House File 1200, which would ban private prisons in the state of Minnesota. Madam Chair and members, criminal justice is the core responsibility of our state's government, and it should be done by those who are accountable to the public. Public workers should be the ones protecting our public safety. This is what AFSCME workers do at the correctional facility in St. Cloud, and it's what AFSCME workers do at our prisons and county jails every day all throughout our state, often putting their own safety at risk for the public good of keeping us safe. The U.S. imprisons more people, both per capita and in absolute terms, than any other nation in the world. Our prisons are full, and overcrowding is an issue, but private prisons are not the solution to this problem. In fact, Madam Chair and members, they make the problem worse. Private prisons are notorious for cutting corners in order to maximize profits, which jeopardizes public safety. Some examples of this include reports of worms found in food served to inmates, lack of medical care for inmates, lower pay and benefits for staff, which decreases the quality of work, less training for staff, staffing levels so low that prison gangs are out of control, and sometimes in control of the correctional operation, increases in the number of prison rapes, successfully higher rates of assaults on both staff and inmates, and higher rates of recidivism because private prisons do not adequately fund rehabilitation programs, including treatment for drug abuse or mental illness. And there really lies the crux of the problem, Madam Chair and members. Private prisons have perverse incentives. Recidivism is good for the bottom line. More crime means more profit. More incarceration means more profit. Public safety takes a back seat to private profit. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong with private profit per se, but it should not be at the expense of public safety. Public safety has to come first. Private prisons are not the solution to increasing crime and skyrocketing incarceration. They're part of the problem, and it's time that we ban them here in Minnesota. That's why I'm bringing forward House File 1200. And, Madam Chair, before I introduce this to the testifiers that we have here today, I'd like to recognize the work that's been done on this issue and on this bill in the past. This bill has been brought forward by many correctional officers in St. Cloud, some of whom now are retired, but continue to show up and to put this bill forward so that we can make sure that those who are incarcerated do have that level, that level of safety, that level of care that they deserve from our public workers. And I would also like to recognize the efforts of the past legislators who have put this bill forward, particularly that of our former majority leader, Representative Ryan Winkler, who chief authored this bill in 2019 and 2021, and put in significant work to advance this bill, not only through the legislature, but to advance this issue through the arena of public opinion and really shine a light on both the horrible things that are happening at private prisons, but also to uplift the good work that is done by our public workers at our public prison facilities. So with that, Madam Chair, I do have some testifiers who can speak further to this bill.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. And we do have a little over 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes or so left. So if our testifiers can just keep that in mind, because I want to make sure that we can get a vote before we leave and have member discussion as well. The first testifier is Matt Kringle. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Matt Kringle. I'm a corrections sergeant with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. I work at the St. Cloud Prison. I've been there for over 22 years now. I'm also a member of AFSCME Council 5 and the president of our local 599 union there. I'm here to testify in support of House File 1200. I want to thank Representative Wolgamott for authoring this legislation, and it's to prohibit the State Department of Corrections from contracting with private prison corporations for the care, custody, and rehabilitation of offenders. As a frontline worker for the Department of Corrections, I can tell you that our top priority is public safety. I want everybody in Minnesota to feel safe from the offenders who have breached the public trust. And very importantly to me, I want my coworkers and friends to go home safe at the end of their shift, which doesn't always happen. I want to provide a safe setting for incarcerated individuals to finish their sentences. But our pursuit of public safety extends beyond incarceration time. Our goal is to have, obviously, low recidivism rates, as low as possible, and for formerly incarcerated people to become contributing, successful members of society upon their release from our custody. This is not the case for private prisons. They operate under the guise of public safety, but their top priority is to turn a profit for their shareholders, and it often comes at the expense of public safety. They have an incentive to increase their population and increase their recidivism rates. I have colleagues who have worked in states that have contracted with private prisons, and they share horror stories about what happens in those prisons, from cutting programming and education, cutting training for staff, operating with skeletal security crews, cuts to public food service, lack of cleaning and upkeep of physical plant, and of course, cutting wages and benefits for staff, which does not provide them the quality workers they need. I've been doing this for a long time. I can tell you from experience that programming, decent food, and adequate staffing levels and facility cleanliness contribute to safety inside the facilities. Cuts to programming and educational opportunities will lead to higher recidivism and jeopardize public safety on release. I don't believe this is a partisan issue. I hope everybody on this committee votes in favor of this legislation, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Emily Leffoltz on behalf of the DOC administration. I didn't see you behind the chairs, so there you are. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and members. I'm here on behalf, my name is Emily Leffoltz. I am legislative director at the Department of Corrections. You won't see me up here often because I know Commissioner Schnell really likes to be here and talk to you himself. There are a few instances where he can't, and one of those are parole hearings, and so that's where he is today. Thanks for the chance to testify on this. Thank you for the chance to do that, Representative, and for offering the bill. Also, thank you to all the advocates that have been working on this for years. As you all know, Minnesota does not have any private prisons currently running, and it's important and a priority of this administration to codify that into statute. Core functions of public safety, in particular incarcerating individuals that the state finds that need to be incarcerated, should remain a duty of the state. And so the administration, the Department of Corrections, fully supports this this bill. Not just for the sake of that value, but for the sake of the people, the safety and security of the people that are incarcerated, but also very importantly, the staff of those facilities. And just as a side note, those staff who you see in the audience here today have some of the most difficult jobs, I think, in public safety, and are critical to positive outcomes in public safety, and you don't often see them out and around public, but you see them here today. So I just wanted to thank them for being here and just make sure that everyone understands we fully support this bill. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. We had one member of the public sign up, Devin Bruce with me. Please welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Public Affairs Coordinator for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. We represent about 15,000 state workers across all agencies and boards, including the therapeutical, clinical staff, educational staff at the DOC correctional facilities. One thing I just wanted to highlight and not go over some of the safety concerns as well as recidivism rates is not only nationally but here in Minnesota, we've had a horrible track record with private prisons in operation, particularly previously the now defunct Prairie Correctional Facility in Appleton. And there was a study done back in the late 90s that highlighted some of these issues that were spoken about previously. First, that the Appleton Prairie Correctional Facility had a 13 times higher rearrest and 22% higher reconviction rates of people released back into the public. Additionally, there in that study, there was also people who were interviewed that were incarcerated there, and the Prairie Correctional Facility had subcontracted to provide full-time, 6 hour per day, 5 day per week, chemical dependency treatment to be made available for everyone. That that would hopefully mirror the DOC's already proven and quality programming for chemical dependency. But what had actually happened is once the contract was executed, it was never materialized. So hopefully we can continue with the quality programming that DOC and my members provide, as well as the safety that our COs provide here today. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Anybody else from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? All right, I'm not seeing any, so we can move now to member discussion. I'm hearing knocking. No, that doesn't mean you're okay. Representative Whitty.
I don't know which one would be better. Maybe to ask me testifier if they could come down for this question.
Yeah, Mr. Kringle, if you want to work your way back, go ahead and ask your question.
My question is, would it be worth while for the state to purchase it if they were able to get a good deal on it and run it through our state group?
Representative, are you talking about the Appleton?
Appleton, yeah.
Okay, and that I don't know if that would be a Commissioner Schnell question too, but go ahead, Mr. Kringle.
I don't believe so because of its location and the fact that there's no level one trauma centers anywhere close to it to respond to like severe assaults for both staff and offender. And it's, like I said, very hard for us to get our buses there on the two lane roads. And then the response times for our SWAT teams and stuff.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Any follow up, Representative Whitty?
One other question for you, Madam Chair. We've talked about tours before, and I appreciate you let people know that it is the prison day at the Capitol. I've met, and it sounds like they would like us to do a tour, and I think that would be great. We've talked about doing a tour, and I think it would give us all a good understanding of, you know, some of the things. So I know it's separate from this, but with them all here, I think it would be a great opportunity for all of us to do a tour.
Yeah,
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up again. And I was need to set that up probably over the interim, something like that. So thank you for the reminder. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And Representative Witte addressed most of my concerns, but just saying, having been in several of the state facilities for work in the past, thank you for your work. It is work that is so important, because that contact that the clients that you have with the staff, that interaction that we have with that, that they will have with the staff, is probably the most important thing, as you described, in what's going to happen when they get back out. So thank you for doing that good work and getting through the COVID. For the ones that were working then, we had multiple hearings just to discuss how critical the staffing levels had got and some of the conditions and the extended hours that you had to work. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wolgamott, thank you for bringing this bill. It's important. And to all of you all that serve in our institutions, thank you for the work you do. And I'll be visiting one of them this month, toward the end of the month, so maybe I'll run into some of you all. Looking forward to that.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Any further comments? All right, Representative Wolgamott, closing comments.
Well, thank you again, Madam Chair, and Lee Novotny, and members of the committee, for the opportunity to present House File 1200. It comes down to this. Incarceration should be done by the government and by those who are accountable to the public. Private prisons and their workers are focused on profit, whereas our public correctional facilities and the public workers who staff them are focused on correction, rehabilitation, and integration back into our society. Madam Chair, I would like to recognize all of the correctional workers who are here with us today. We thank you for the work that you do. It is grueling, it is tough on you and on your families, but you show up every day and you do your work and you keep our community safe. Thank you for doing that work. Let's make sure that all of our correctional facilities have public workers in them taking care of public safety. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. I ask for your support to send House File 1200 to the General Register.
Thank you. And with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1200 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thanks again. Thank you, Representative Wolgamott, for being here today. And members, we have, I believe, three bills on fourth Thursday. Yep. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.